Hello, and welcome to episode 2 of the MockVirgil.com Gamecast. This time, we will be continuing our discussion on StarCraft, this time focusing our energy towards the previously mentioned race-specific tactics. I will be spending today speaking about the Terrans, the crafty human faction of the famous StarCraft game. To begin, I'm going to just kind of give you a quick summary. Of the three races, the Terrans are the ones that we're sort of introduced to first. They are sort of mid-ranged with, you know, with the Zerg being more on the weaker but plentiful end of the scale and the Protoss on the fewer but more powerful end of the scale. The Terrans are sort of middle of the road, but that's not to say that they don't have units that can't stand up to the Protoss toe-to-toe, or that they don't have units that aren't able to swarm, or that aren't good for swarming tactics, much like the Zerg. Really, the Terrans' calling card is their special abilities. They have more special abilities available to them per unit than any of the other sides in the game. Some of these special abilities do need to be researched to be unlocked, but in total, the Terrans are without a doubt a micromanager's dream. That said, it is important to state that despite the emphasis on micromanagement, that the Terrans are the easiest race probably to learn off the bat, which is why I believe Blizzard introduced them first in the original StarCraft campaign. The Terrans are a much more defensive race than the other two, and this manifests itself in most importantly in the way that it builds defensive structures, well, the way it builds structures at all, and the all-important siege tank. The Terrans really have a general lack of units that are well-suited for the task of battering down the door of your enemy by force, and usually requires a more crafty approach to base assault. That's not to say the Terrans don't have powerful weapons that, when deployed, you need to be careful, but you're less likely to have a situation where a Terran player is just going to build a whole giant ass ton of units and are just going to be able to select them and press the Abe key and select somewhere in their enemy's base and just automatically win. As opposed to with the Protoss and the Zerg, where it's much more possible to overcome your enemy with brute force. That is not to say the Terrans are weak. When properly used, the Terran special abilities have just devastating power and can easily overcome your defenses in ways that can be a complete and total nuisance. So, without further ado, let us begin our discussion by going through each of the units for the Terrans one by one. Now, I will speak briefly on the Brood War units, but I don't want to speak on them too much because it is my intention to have a podcast later that discusses the difference between StarCraft and Brood War, and I will spend more time speaking on the differences that the new units for each faction add. My desire to go over each of the units follows the format that was done in the original Virgil's Guides to Playing StarCraft, where I went through an in-depth analysis of each unit available for each race. I don't want to spend as much time on that as I did in the written format, and most of this is because Blizzard has a website for StarCraft called the StarCraft Compendium. You can go to the site at www.battle.net/scc. And you will be able to access from each of the race's strategies section a very detailed list of each unit and their stats. So rather than sit here and worry about boring you with each particular statistic verbally, I will simply go over the strengths and weaknesses of various units and how they might be used before going into general strategy. All right. So, let us begin by speaking about the Terran Marine. Now, the Marine is the first combat unit that is made available to the Terrans upon the beginning of the game. The Marine is a small-sized unit, not very durable, doesn't have very many hit points, and not very powerful on the attack. He only has one more point of attack power than the Zergling, which makes him just disparagingly weak compared to the Protoss Zealot. Having said that, the Marine has a unique is unique from the Zergling and the Zealot in that, despite, you know, that his name doesn't begin with the letter Z, he's able to do ranged damage. The Terrans are the only race that can produce a ranged combat unit off the get-go without having to build any additional research structures to add to their ground unit capability. This gives them a leg up in air defense throughout the entire game, since Marines are not as difficult to produce and are easily placed anywhere on the map. They can still be effective anti-air units for most of the game. Now, Marines are an interesting unit in that they start out a decently powerful unit, able to handle its weight in Zerglings pretty well due to the ranged combat scenario, but are severely weak versus the Protoss Zealot, which often leads to many new StarCraft players getting the impression right off the bat of how powerful the Protoss are, with how easily three Zealots can tear through twice their weight or more Marines as if it was like child's play. This comes from the Terran, the Marine's minimal 40 hit points, and its non-existent armor without upgrades. However, one of the key things about the Marine to remember is its minimal 50 mineral cost means that it's a very, very inexpensive unit, which makes for some inexpensive air defense in a pinch. The Marine also performs quite well in large units. At such a low cost, you'd be surprised at how effective a batch of 12 of these things can perform against many adversaries. Not so much high armor, high damage units like the Zealot, per se, but against slower firing units like the Protoss Dragoon, a large pack of Marines do quite well. So one of the things just to keep in mind is the fact that the Marine really never stops being useful over the course of a game. They just make excellent shock troopers. You can throw them in at any time. And really, if your enemy doesn't have a thick enough defense, early game, they really do an excellent job of just shooting through the enemy's defenses. Also keep in mind the advantage that Marines have of being able to fire from higher terrain at lower targets. Now, it's at this point that I do want to speak very briefly about Terran defenses. One of the pivotal destructures used in a Terran defensive line is the bunker. The bunker is really useless by itself. It doesn't have any functionality except for maybe impairing enemy movement. But the bunker is able to hold up to four Terran infantry types, be them Marines, Firebats, Ghosts, Medics, or SCVs, in any combination. Proper use of or proper allotment of which Terran infantries go into a bunker is a key part of making your defenses effective. Against Terran foes, who are much less likely to employ melee tactics, with the only melee unit in the entire army being the Firebat, it is much more useful for you to fill up your bunkers with four Marines than bother putting a Firebat in there. On the other hand, against Protoss opponents who are likely to rely on the more melee-focused Archon or Zealot or Dark Templar to get the job done, throwing as many as two Firebats in a bunker might not be as bad of an idea. So, moving on from Marines, let's move on to the Firebat. The Terran Firebat is the second infantry unit made available to the Terrans, and it is basically a Marine with slightly thicker armor, as in 10 more hit points, 1 point more armor, and flamethrowers attached to his arm. Now, here's the thing about the Firebat, is it's really hard at first for, I know that a lot of new players, and I'm included in this when I was new, didn't really see the value of the Firebat, because it seemed like they were, you know, not much tougher than the Marine, and yet charged with getting in up close to the enemy, and they would just die constantly. And, you know, let's be honest, Terran infantry, they die a lot. That's kind of what they do, and you're supposed to build a lot of them to sort of mitigate the losses that you know you will suffer. But there's a few big things that Firebats need to be, you need to consider when thinking about Firebats, and the really big one is the fact that their weapons base do as much damage as a Protoss Zealot's. They have a ground attack strength of 16, and unlike the Protoss Zealot, whose attack is single target only, the Firebat's attack is area of effect. The result of this is actually a very terrifying reality for Protoss ground troops, that a much cheaper composition of Terran infantry, a mixed group of Marines and Firebats, can do a devastating amount of damage to a Protoss ground force. Even if the Terran units don't win in the end, the economic weight of such a 12-unit group and the amount of damage it'll do to the Protoss before they fall is kind of a chilling reality. Firebats, you know, they don't hold up very long against Zealots, but you can build two for every one Zealot in existence, given their 50 mineral cost, provided you have Vespian gas to satiate it. And if you have Marines to back them up, you know, once the Firebats die, they will have laid enough area of effect flames upon the Zealots that the group of them probably won't have enough hit points to survive against the ongoing bullets afterwards. Firebats are also even better for killing Zerglings than Marines are, since they're able to basically, a single Firebat can drop a Zergling in two shots, and the AoE effect really helps to counter the clumping that Zerglings tend to do. Firebats, like Marines, are placeable in bunkers, and are quite handy when located inside them if you're going against more melee-based attackers. Of course, the problem with Firebats remains that they're melee-only, so this means that they can't really help your bunkers defend against air units. So, once you've built your Marines and Firebats, chances are you're going to go ahead and build a factory and start working towards the Terran vehicles. I'll begin the discussion on Terran vehicles with the Vulture. The Vulture is a unit that, I will admit, in all my years of playing StarCraft, I always viewed it as a mostly useless unit. It was the closest thing this game has to a useless unit. My reason for this is because, well, it doesn't have a lot of hit points, 80, which is not... It could be worse. I mean, it's obviously more than a Marine, and given that it only costs about 25 more minerals than a Marine, it's an okay upgrade. And it moves really, really fast, but the problem with the Vulture is the fact that its attack, which does do 20 damage, the damage type is concussive. To explain very briefly, there's a hidden damage system in StarCraft where weapons either do normal concussive or explosive damage. The short of it is that normal weapons do full damage to any type of target, while concussive weapons are more effective against small targets like infantry, zerglings, and such, and grow increasingly less effective against larger targets. So firing concussive weapons at structures is generally a slow and painful process. And explosive weapons are the opposite, which are more effective against large targets, but decreasingly effective against smaller targets, which is why, even though Terran siege tanks do 70 damage out the gate, they might not succeed in blowing up a single siege tank, might not blow up a single Zergling in one shot, because of the explosive effect reduces how much damage it does total. The Vulture suffers from this problem in that its 20 damage attack is only concussive, which means that the unit is going to be effective against resource gatherers, Marines, Zealots, and Zerglings, and whatnot. But once the enemy starts building up things like Dragoons, Hydralisks, and air units, and that sort of thing, and honestly, by the time you're talking of Vultures, we are usually talking larger units for your enemy, the concussive grenades really are just not that impressive anymore. And even further, I mean, at least the normal attacks of Marines feel like they do more damage and blow up structures faster than Vultures do. However, Vultures are still very, very fast, and can be upgraded to be even faster, which makes them an excellent and relatively inexpensive scouting unit. which is very handy if you want to kind of lay out, if you want to get a layout of the map and you haven't done so yet. The other handy thing about the Vulture is they're the only unit that the factory can produce that doesn't use up Vespian gas. So if you're sitting there in a situation where you're running low on gas and you know you want to make an assault, but you want some slightly thicker units than just Marines to run with your Marines, the Vulture might not be a bad idea for damage soak. So, however, the real special ability of the Vulture is to keep in mind that they have an ability called Spider Mine. Now, Spider Mines, as their name implies, are droppable on the ground, and they stick themselves in and cloak themselves, so they're invisible unless you have a detector handy. Now, spider mines aren't detectors in that they don't reveal cloaked units for you, but they are capable of popping out and attacking cloaked units all the same, unless that's changed since I quit playing, which I don't think it has. What this means is a Terran player can take advantage of Vultures to plant mines around their base or in other key areas to lie ambushes for their opponents or try and make their base extra defended. Got a problem with an enemy Terran player who likes nuking you but always sends his ghost the same way? Drop some spider mines. Got a problem with a Protoss player trying to use Dark Templar on you? Use spider mines. Now, unfortunately, a Vulture can only drop 3 spider mines before it's completely out, and there's no way to replenish them. But at 75 minerals per bike, you know, if you think about that, what you're really paying for is the 3 spider mines once you have the upgrade. And 75 minerals for 3 mines, I mean, that's 25 minerals a pop. That's really not all that bad. So, another thing to keep in mind is that the micromanaging crazies over in Korea have figured out how to use the Vulture offensively. I personally can't reproduce this, but it's possible, apparently, to take a group of Vultures and kind of move in this heading towards and away from your opponent sort of motion to keep your opponent kind of moving towards the Vultures. And as the Vultures flee, you kind of run towards the enemy and plant a bunch of spider mines around them. The spider mines will plop down, immediately plop back up, and then rush headlong at the enemy, just doing incredible amounts of damage. And believe it or not, I've seen videos of these Korean players taking advantage of Vultures to drop entire, like, 12-person units of Dragoons, Siege Tanks, such and such, in the blink of an eye. If you're curious to see how this is done, try and look up on YouTube some of the gameplay footage from a Terran player known as Slayers Boxer. That's S-L-A-Y-E-R-S, Boxer. He gained the acknowledgement in the Korea as the Emperor of Terran for his incredible micromanagement, and this particular skill tactic was one that he employed. After the Vulture, we have the Siege Tank. Now, the Siege Tank is probably, and rightly so, one of the most feared units in the Terran arsenal. And this is because it is one of the few true artillery units in the game and is incredibly effective at being one. The Siege Tank starts out in its normal tank mode and is not that great of a unit. It could be worse. It's actually got a reasonable amount of hit points, some pretty good starting armor, and does, you know, some pretty good damage, although it still fires much too slowly and to really be good for anything that you usually use tanks for in another RTS, like, say, Command & Conquer, for rushing an enemy base headlong and expecting their armor to soak up the offensive cannon fire. However, you can research for the Siege Tank's a special ability called Siege Mode. This ability causes the Siege Tank to plant itself stationary, meaning it can no longer move, but then it converts its cannon into a long-range shock cannon that does 70 damage explosive base. Now, the explosive part, as mentioned previous, means that it does not do full damage to smaller units, but when you put two of these things together, basically there's no small unit that's going to stand up to that. The Siege Tank is an important part of any Terran defense, giving the Terrans the ability to stand on high ground against much, much greater numbers and defend their base against a much more difficult rush. The siege tank is also ideal for attacking, because it allows the Terrans, its firing range is greater than any static defense available to any race. The only thing that can match, only thing on the ground that can match its attack range is the Protoss Reaver and other siege tanks. And I think maybe Zerg Lurkers, though I'll have to look into that to be certain. And that's a Brood War unit, so we're really not worried about them at the moment anyway. And the siege tanks, have a one-up on the Reavers, and that Reavers can only fire at their target if there's a straight path for the Scarabs to travel, whereas the siege tanks do an arcing fire thing of an actual projectile, which means they can fire up and down cliffs just fine. So as awesome as siege tanks are at decimating bases and holding defenses and destroying defenses from long range and just eradicating everything, they are not to be used by themselves. It is important to note that building an attack group that's just a pack of siege tanks is a waste of your money. Siege tanks by themselves are ineffective, and there's a few reasons for this. The first of which is siege tanks have no way to defend themselves against the air. They cannot shoot their shock cannons at air units, so an enemy with air units will be able to destroy your attack group of siege tanks in no time flat. Problem number two is that when in siege mode, the siege tanks cannot fire point blank, meaning that fast-moving Zealot and Zerglings can get in up close on the siege tank and finish it off before it can fire off and its shots. And even if you're in a group of siege tanks and some of them aren't in point blank, the explosive splash damage of their cannon will probably kill the siege tank being attacked in the efforts to try and defend it. The answer to proper siege tank use is to escort it with some units that are very good at close quarters combat and air-to-air combat, and it is for that reason that I strongly recommend pairing them alongside either Marines or Goliaths based off where you are in your technology level. Marines and Goliaths both do fairly rapid fire damage, are excellent close, can do pretty good close range, and can shoot against air targets. It's also a good idea to bring with your siege tank attack group a cloak detection unit like the Science Vessel, so that you're able to pick up on cloaked air units like enemy Wraiths, or cloaked units like Dark Templar or Terran Ghosts that seek to lock down your siege tanks. Okay, after the siege tank and you've built an armory, you can build the Goliath. Now, the Goliath is in some ways an upgrade for the Marine, and in some ways is not. The Goliath has going for it that it has significantly more hit points than the Marine, significantly more armor than the Marine, does more than twice as much damage as the Marine on the ground, and is even more so against air units. It only costs 100 minerals, which feels cheap compared to the siege tank's 150, and it takes a little bit to build. However, the Goliath has a few things going against it, the first of which is it's a pretty big unit, which means it's more susceptible to enemy siege tank fire or explosive damage attacks than the Marine is. Problem number two is that because of its size, you can only fit 4 in a dropship instead of 8. So if you're going for an aerial assault method, you're probably going to get more bang for your buck out of 4 Marines, or out of 8 Marines, than you are out of 4 Goliaths. Unless, of course, we're talking about the enemy who focuses a lot on air. Having said that, there have been times, and in fact very recently I played a game where I made very aggressive use of Goliaths in much the same capacity that I tend to use Marines, and there is something to be said for their increased hit points and attack strength that can really add up in a base assault. Goliaths, you know, they don't have quite enough to be a good base puncher, mostly because of their large profile, it makes it difficult for them to walk up ramps and such, and they usually get bottlenecked very easily. But when that's not a concern, a large number of Goliaths firing in sequence can do some pretty heavy damage to defenses, usually taking minimal casualties. So if you can afford to build up a pretty big group of them, they're pretty devastating. Additionally, their damage type is normal, so, you know, they're going to do damage to everything pretty much the same. Goliaths also really should not be discounted for their incredible anti-air power. Their backpack-mounted rocket launchers are some of the best air-to-ground defense in the game, especially when you can get the Brood War upgrade that gives them a firing range that is competitive with the Zerg Guardian. The attack power of these rockets is equivalent to an air-to-air missile off a Wraith. It can be upgraded quite soundly, so a siege tank protected by a group of Goliaths is in good shape. Another advantage to employing Goliath siege tank combined forces is that if you employ them with an SCV, then the SCV can do field repairs, helping to keep your units alive in the battlefield, which can really add up after a while. Alright, so moving on, let's move on to the Terran air arsenal. The first air units the Terran gets gain is the Wraith. The Wraith is an interesting unit in that its level of effectiveness has fluctuated throughout the history of StarCraft. It started out a very good air-to-air unit, beaten only by the Protoss Scout in its air-to-air capability as far as base air units were concerned. Certainly a much more powerful air-to-air dogfighter than the Zerg Mutalisk is, and it used to have a very high rate of fire on its lasers that meant a large pack of Wraiths were actually pretty good air assaulters. You know, not necessarily enough to stand up to a heap ton of air defense, but if the enemy only had a few token air defenses to protect themselves from an air assault, the Wraiths could do a really good job of surgically going in, removing the air defenses, and then just having a heyday inside the enemy base. The really, really big thing for the Wraith, though, is the ability to upgrade them to have a individual cloaking field. And this is what gives them the leg up over every other race's base air-to-air unit, is definitely the cloaking field. If you get a pack of Wraiths and they go up against a pack of Mutalisks, the Mutalisks might do some damage, but if the Mutalisks don't bring an Overlord with them and you cloak them, Mutalisks can't see you, they can't kill what they can't see. You know, those Protoss scouts might be, you know, more powerful in the air-to-air combat category, but if the Protoss don't bring an observer with them or some other detector, the Wraiths can go cloak and can just destroy them en masse. Wraiths are excellent ambushers, they're excellent escorters for transports. When employed properly, the Wraith can be very, very useful. That being said, they are extremely fragile, and they have been nerfed in the air-to-ground combat capacity, so you're probably going to find yourself better suited to assaulting an enemy base by weakening some air defenses with Wraiths, but then relying on a drop-off of some sort of Terran ground units to finish off the base, as opposed to doing a protracted assault with the Wraiths, unless you have a large enough group of them. Okay, so then you have the dropship. The dropship is the token transport unit for the Terrans. It is able to ferry, just like everyone else's, 8 small units, 4 medium-sized units, and 2 large units. Its costs are fairly marginal, 100 minerals and 100 gas, which I guess it's not as marginal, but still, it's not too bad. The dropship is a medium-speed transport, starting out faster than the Protoss shuttle and faster than the Zerg Overlord, although not as fast as either of them when upgraded. The dropship cannot be upgraded to go any faster, but it still goes at a pretty good clip in general. It doesn't have any weapons of its own, so it's not useful for combat in any way, but it is indispensable for keeping a mobile Terran force alive. The dropship will often be used in various attempts to assault any particular area or enemy base that is defended by just raw terrain. There isn't too much more to say about the dropship, at least not here. When we get into tactics involving how to deal with island maps or high ground, we can talk about that more, but loading them up with an effective group of units is a very important thing. Alright, after the dropship, we have the science vessel. The science vessel is another one of those units that, on the face value, doesn't seem all that useful. It doesn't have any weapon of its own, and all it has to go for it are special abilities. Well, you see, the thing in StarCraft is that every race has one flying sort of special ability mage unit type thing and one ground one. For the Terrans, that airy one is the science vessel and the ground one is the ghost, which we haven't talked about yet, and I'm going to get to that in a minute. The science vessel is actually an incredibly handy unit for a number of reasons. The first one is that it's a flying detector unit, which means it's invaluable when it comes to escorting your attack groups. Yes, the Terrans do have the Comsat station. You can use it to help you out in a pinch, but I find that you are going to enjoy much more success if you escort your units with a science vessel so that you can detect cloaked units and maybe make use of some of the science vessel's special abilities to help you out. Include the Defensive Matrix, Irradiate, and EMP Shockwave. Defensive Matrix. The Terrans, unlike the Protoss, have not invented shields yet. The Defensive Matrix is an attempt to sort of place an experimental energy barrier around a single Terran unit. This barrier effectively doubles the Terran's hit points temporarily, giving the Terran unit this shiny blue sort of rotating nuclear effect around it or something. It's difficult to describe. But when the unit gets fired on, it looks like they have a shield protecting them. This ability is incredibly valuable when placed around units with high armor and hit points, just significantly increasing their durability on the battlefield, and can help to turn the tide of an otherwise losing battle. At only 100 energy, an upgraded science vessel can use this ability twice before it runs out of energy, which is just fantastic. Irradiate is a very handy ability to use against enemy organic units. The ability will slowly kill the unit over time, and it emits this green energy around it that damages anything it touches. This is incredibly useful against enemy units that tend to swarm together or pack together, and it results in the radiation damaging all units nearby. So handy things to use it on includes large Zerg air groups. Since they all count as organic, you can kind of nuke them down slowly like that. Terran infantry groups, Zerg ground swarms. I'm personally not sure how effective Radiate is on the Protoss. It seems like it's not. Anytime I've tried to use it, it didn't work out, but I could be wrong. What is useful against the Protoss, on the other hand, is EMP Shockwave. This ability is just invaluable against the Protoss, and any Terran player who knows they're out going up against the Protoss and doesn't research this ability is being either extremely cocky or isn't thinking right. The EMP Shockwave is critical because it knocks out any energy-dependent supply on a unit when it goes off. How this means is that enemy mage units like Templar, Scourges, Ghosts, Science Vessels, Battlecruisers who rely on energy for their Yamato Cannon, Ghosts who rely on energy for their cloaking, as well as Wraiths who rely on energy for their cloaking, will have their energy instantly zeroed if they're hit with the EMP Shockwave. Yeah, got a pack of Wraiths harassing your base, and you don't want to waste the time, making some sort of detector unit to uncloak them. Drop an EMP on the whole lot of them, they'll instantly decloak, and they'll have no way to cloak back for quite some time. But the real kicker is that EMP Shockwave will instantly zero the shields of any Protoss unit or structure hit with it. Given how much shields contribute to the defensive capability of everything in the Protoss arsenal, this is devastating. You'll notice that many of the harder structures might require two nuclear drops from a ghost to be destroyed. Many Protoss structures, once EMP'd, will go down in one nuke. It's fantastic. You just cannot afford to overlook the EMP when playing against Protoss. Another thing that I've seen Korean players manage to micromanage, and I still can't believe this is possible, but, you know, I saw it on a video, so I imagine it is. It's apparently possible if you have two science vessels for them to irradiate each other. Being non-organic, this shouldn't hurt them, but if you then take them and drive them headlong into an enemy air cluster like a bunch of enemy guardians, you can slowly kill them, and it gives you a way to eradicate them in one fell swoop. Okay. So I saved the best for last. I wanted to talk about the two really devastating endgame shockers the Terran have at their disposal. Many Terran players get the impression that this choosing between these two big weapons is an either-or discussion, and this is a mistake. The reason why they feel this way is that in order to get access to the two real endgame triggers for the Terrans, the nuke or the battlecruiser, each of them require a different add-on to the Terran science facility, either a covert ops or a physics lab. And the idea is that, well, if I build one, I can't build the other, but it's not true. You just need two science facilities, which, if you're planning on investing our nukes and, or battlecruisers, you should have the money to afford two science facilities if you want to. Now, mind you, that's not to say you have to. Some players prefer the nuke and really see no need to build battlecruisers, and other players are victory fleet addicts, and so they need their battlecruisers and don't really go for the nukes, and you know, there's nothing wrong with that. I just want to make sure that you don't get it in your head as a Terran player that you have to pick between the two of them. If you want to do both, for the love of God, do both. Okay, having said that, I want to talk about the battlecruiser first. It's been a while since I've participated in the online scene, but when I first got into StarCraft almost 10 years ago, one of the things I noticed was many players were relying on battlecruisers for their victories. By this I don't mean, you know, they made balanced use of them. I mean, they hunkered themselves in their base, never expanding, built up 12 battlecruisers as fast as they could, rushed out, and hoped nobody was expecting it, and that would give them the automatic win. And the scary thing was in the early days, we knew so little about how to counter battlecruisers that they usually did win for it. This tactic is referred to as victory fleeting. Since it was implied that a 12 battlecruiser fleet was an automatic victory unless countered with another battlecruiser fleet. And this sort of resulted in a sort of short-lived impression that the Zerg were an inferior race to play as because, you know, you could victory fleet with the Protoss using carriers, you could victory fleet with the Terrans using battlecruisers, and whereas the Zerg really didn't have a victory fleeting unit, and they still don't. And to be honest, they don't need it. I have a lot of dislike for the victory fleet tactic that kind of harkens back to my days of playing StarCraft back then because it seemed like such a cheap out, and after a while you get so used to seeing them that you end up developing a list of counters that can just leave a victory fleet biased player just open for destruction, if for no other reason than because they made the mistake, see previous podcast, of not expanding. Meaning in many cases you could destroy them long before they even pad their first battlecruiser and or wait until they, you know, send them out of their base out in the open where they're weak, demolish the heck out of them, and suddenly he's all out of money and will probably QQ and quit the game. Anyway, having said that, there is some validity to the use of battlecruisers in such large groups. The important thing to remember is, remember when I started this podcast, I mentioned that the Terrans lack units that are tough enough to really push through an enemy base and just bear down their front door and destroy them. Well, that unit, boys and girls, is the battlecruiser. They do have one, it's just incredibly expensive and requires you to climb all the way up the tech tree to get it. But if you get it, good God, if you have enough of them, you can just brute force your way through an enemy base. And this is a... Now, that's true. But what's even more true is when used properly, with right support, battlecruisers are disturbingly unstoppable. And it's not because you can just build a crap ton of them and send them out. It's because they have abilities at their disposal and are good recipients of other abilities to really help them out. So I'll start by talking about the ways to properly do a victory fleet, and then I'll talk a little bit more on how to stop it. It is imperative, if you're going to do a successful victory fleet, that you accompany them with a science vessel. I know I said this before with a science vessel bit, but I cannot stress it enough. If you're going up against an enemy Terran player and you victory fleet without a science vessel, he's going to have wraiths and they're going to ruin you. Or he's going to have ghosts and they're going to ruin you. And there's just no two ways about it. If you have a science vessel, you can do enough. Not only can you detect cloaked units, but you can make use of the EMP shockwave to make your enemy units less effective, especially if you're going up against Protoss. You make use of the defensive matrix to extend the life of an almost dead battlecruiser, which will just infuriate your opponents. You need the science vessel, and sometimes bringing more than one of them is not a bad idea. The other really important thing to keep in mind is while the battlecruiser is capable of barging down someone's front door, he has a special ability that really makes it so he shouldn't have to, and that ability is the Yamato Cannon. When researched, this ability fires a energy bolt at fairly long range, much further range than any air defense that any race can build, that will pretty much one-shot destroy a single air tower. The Zerg Spore Colony is the exception to this, but it's still left pretty close to ruined that you can count it for dead if it's going up against that many battlecruisers. So why do I mention the Yamato Gun? I mention the Yamato Gun because if you take 12 battlecruisers and rush them head forward into an enemy base, all pell-mell, and the enemy has like 12 missile turrets in it, well, chances are you might still win, but you're going to lose half your battlecruisers in the process, if not more. On the other hand, if you surgically go in and Yamato Cannon every single missile turret and then bring the battlecruisers in when there's nothing left to fight them, you've got a destroyed base on your hands. So it's not enough to just use the attack key and throw them in. You know, you want to target the things that are going to stop the battlecruisers first, and then just watch the enemy base burn when they can't do anything about it. Which means a pro tip when fighting against the Protoss is once you've got the photon cannons dead, go for the pylons. Don't waste your time with the unit-producing structures. If you kill the pylons first, they can't make units anyway. And if they don't have pylons, they can't build more photon cannons. If you just focus on the photon cannons and then go on to their gateway, the enemy can regroup, they can build more units, they can build more cannons. Trust me, you will deal a much more severe blow if you just go straight for the pylons. Now, countering the Victory Fleet is actually probably easier with the Terrans than it is with just about any other race because of a few key things. The first being, you have the Cloaked Wraith. If your enemy failed to bring a science vessel, he can't see your wraiths, you're going to ruin him. If he did bring a science vessel and you can take the wraiths and go around behind him and take out the science vessel in one felt swoop and then go for the battlecruisers, you're going to do a lot of damage. Four Goliaths do a very, very good job of killing a single battlecruiser in a surprisingly little time. And you also have the Ghost with its lockdown ability. Since the battlecruisers are mechanical, when locked down, they just float there helpless, waiting to be destroyed. And you'll even be surprised at how effective the weak little Terran Marine in enough numbers can do a number on a battlecruiser. You know, missile turrets may be the biggest threat, but you shouldn't discount how much damage a bunker loaded with marines will do to a battlecruiser over time, either. Point is, if you think an enemy is victory fleeting, don't wait for him to show up at your base. Try to weaken the fleet on the way in. If you can steal his momentum, it will give you more time to prepare. Send out Goliath, send out Wraith, send out whatever you have to slow him down, and if you can take out his valuable science vessels to make him unable to see your cloaked units, the better. Okay, so the other heavy-duty weapon available to the Terrans is the Nuke, and the Nuke comes hand-in-hand with the Terran Ghost, the last infantry unit that I did not discuss. Now, there is something I forgot to discuss earlier, and that's the special ability available to the Marines and the Firebat, and that's a researchable ability called Stimpak. The Stimpak allows the unit to fire and move at double speed for a short period of time at the expense of some of its health. Well, since Terran infantry is generally regarded as expendable anyway, it's oftentimes a good way to try and get a group of Terran units that are already outclassed to go the extra mile. And you'll be surprised at how much more deadly a pack of Marines and Firebats can be once they've been stimmed. Ghosts don't have Stimpak, but instead have a wide array of special abilities, all of which that need to be researched or supported in some way. The Ghosts fire a sniper rifle type thing that is a concussive blast rifle that is pretty good against Terran infantry and other small enemy units, but that's about it. You really don't want to rely on the Ghost for direct assault. You can put them in bunkers to have extra long-range shots, and again, is very effective against enemy assaulting infantry, but not so much at a lot of other things. You might find it's useful against Zerg air attackers, but that's about it. However, the Ghost does have three abilities that are very, very important: personal cloaking, lockdown, and nuke. Personal cloaking works a lot like the Wraith cloaking, except it requires, you know, it's for Ghosts. When cloaked, they can't be seen without an observer, which gives Ghosts the ability to easily move to whatever part of the map they need to get whatever devious job they're up to done. The lockdown is an ability that allows the Terran Ghost to temporarily disable an enemy vehicle for a short amount of time. And this ability, I'll admit, I have a tendency not to research it because it requires a little bit more micromanagement than I like to deal with. But that's not because it's not worth it. If you have an enemy, especially if you're playing against Terrans or Protoss, you know, a lot of the heaviest hitting units in those armies are vehicles, which means they're susceptible to being locked down. So if you're going up against a Terran or Protoss player, you know, and they've got a pack of siege tanks coming, and you've got a pack of Ghosts, you can lock down those siege tanks or battle cruisers or whatever, they are ready to be gunned down by whatever you have to do so. Lockdown lasts a surprisingly long time, so it's not like you have to rush out in 10 seconds to do something about it. And unless you're playing in Brood War, your enemy is powerless to stop you when you lock something down. But the real showstopper for the Terran Ghost is the nuke. Now, the way the nuke works is you have to build an add-on to a command center called the Nuclear Silo. This means you need to have probably a second command center, since if your first command center didn't have a commsat station attached to it, well, you're probably not playing in Brood War, because you didn't need detection early on, and you usually want that. And even if you are playing a normal StarCraft, I still recommend the commsat station for the simple point that it allows you to scan out, find out where your enemy is, and spy on what he's building and where he's located very, very easily. The Nuclear Silo allows you to build a nuke so long as you have a science facility with a covert ops attached. The nuke is just as expensive as the battlecruiser supply-wise, but is about half the cost in minerals and gas. Once researched, the nuke can't be fired from the silo in standard, you know, push-button warfare style. It must be guided by the laser sight of the Ghost's rifle to its target. So you must take the Ghost, walk him to where you would like to drop the nuke, click the, you know, nuclear strike button, and then click where you would like it to go off. The Ghost will then ceremoniously stand in place and cause a flashing red dot to appear where the nuke will drop. When this dot is finished blinking, the nuke will drop down and cause all kinds of incredible damage to enemies. Most units in the game, if not all units in the game, will die in one nuke, and many structures will die in one nuke too, or die shortly thereafter by simply being poked. You can also build multiple command centers with multiple nuclear silos to allow either multiple Ghosts to nuke at once, or to allow one Ghost to pull off multiple nukes in succession. Now, while a Ghost is holding down the pinpoint to lead a nuclear missile home, he cannot move, he cannot take any action. So this is where having personal cloaking is important, because you want to cloak that Ghost before he begins placing the dot on the nuke, or else he's going to die in, like, three shots. Not even three shots, just going to go down real easy. And if the Ghost dies before the nuke reaches his target, then the nuke is wasted. Utterly and totally wasted. Yeah, another thing to point out is that when you spend 200 minerals and 200 gas on that nuke, the nuke's gone once you've fired it, so you'll have to spend it again if you expect to fire another nuke, so it's a recurring cost that adds up after a while. Having said that, if your enemy is inept for whatever reason at finding and stopping your Ghost, either because it's a computer AI or a player who really panics when they hear the nuclear launch detected message and just cannot find that red dot, a few well-placed nukes will render an enemy from powerful to nothing. in no time flat. So it's a risky maneuver, but if you practice with it and you can get a constant rotation of nukes going, you can cripple a once functioning player in like no time flat. Okay, so a quick discussion on the units added in Brood War. The Terrans gained two new units in Brood War, and that's the Medic and the Valkyrie. The Medic is a Terran infantry unit that is able to heal other Terran infantry units automatically when she stands near them. She conveniently, her heal command has the same shortcut key as the attack command, A, so generally she will follow around your infantry and heal them as they take damage. There's some AI issues with this where if the if your guys stop and start shooting and they don't start getting damaged, then the medics might keep going without them, and you might need to micro it a little bit, but by and large, you can just rely on the A key to make sure that your medics will stick with your Terran infantry. What's great about medics is the fact that they will heal the infantry from any damage whatsoever, including Stimpak damage, so if you're hesitant about using Stimpak before because you didn't like the idea of using an ability that damaged your own units, medics take away that fear from you entirely. When supported by medics, 8 Marines are actually capable of taking out a bunker by themselves, especially with Stimpak, so medics are your friend. When you get to Brood War, you will find that you're going to start filling up Terran infantry groups with a pack of medics and a pack of Marines in a couple dropships, and this sort of Terran mobile infantry combat style is quite effective. The second new unit for the Terrans is the Valkyrie, and the Valkyrie is a unit that it almost seems like without it, you don't quite before Brood War, you really don't understand, like, what do the Terrans need an air-to-air specific unit for? And it almost seems like they threw it in because they gave an air-to-air specific unit to the Protoss. The Valkyrie, however, is very, very powerful at destroying enemy air swarms. Not by itself. A single Valkyrie isn't all that effective, but once you get about 6 of them together, the combined effect of their halo missiles kind of produces this do not enter zone or you will die for enemy air units. And I say zone because if you have it affects an area. If you have a pack of Zerg air units that are stuck clumped together in a clusterfuck, you may very well kill all of them in a few shots. The Valkyrie is just hands down the most powerful air-to-air combat unit in the game. It goes toe-to-toe with equal numbers of Protoss scouts, especially at 6 and up, and just makes a mockery of them. I had a game once where I was playing Protoss. I went up against a Terran player who built 12 Valkyries, who escorted around 12 dropships that were carrying 2 siege tanks each, and he decimated me with that. I sent 12 scouts up against those Valkyries, figuring they would win, and they lost big time. Of course, the big problem with the Valkyrie is, unlike the Wraith, it does not have a cloak field, and it has no ability to shoot against ground units, so making proper use of it is important. Much like the siege tank, you can't have it run around by itself, or else it's going to have a hard time with Hydralisks, Goliaths, Dragoons, etc. Terran's strategies and tactics, I've already covered a few of them in quick coverall when talking about the units, but allow me to sort of illustrate how one should kind of approach the philosophy to playing Terran. In general, when starting a multiplayer game, the best way to defend yourself against a rush is to prepare yourself to rush yourself. That way, when your enemy brings in his rush force, you already have one of your own waiting, and you have the advantage of it's your base. So if he actually does somehow manage to defeat your rush force, now he has to make it past, you know, your ability for you to build additional units. So if he wins by, like, 2 Marines, you can have 2 Marines out in no time flat. Certainly before he can actually blow up your structures. What I would do is I would begin by trying to get at least 10 minerals, or 10 SCVs on minerals. I spoke a lot last episode about economy and number of SCVs equal to mineral deposits, and I mentioned that 8 is the default. The reason I go with 10 is because it gives me a little bit more of a boost than 8 does, while at the same time not giving me too fast of a burnout. I find that 10 just works generally, and I like to rely on it, but feel free to experiment with other numbers if you're finding that's not generating enough revenue for you, or if you're burning out too fast. Then you want to get yourself, you know, collecting gas and supply depots and two barracks and try to get 12 Marines as fast as you can. Once you have 12 Marines, supplement them with fire bats as fast as you can. If you haven't been rushed yet, then get some bunkers up, preferably two, and stick one fire bat and three Marines in if you still don't know what you're fighting. If you know you're up against Terrans, you should probably do that because of the Terrans still. Because if the Terrans are going to assault you, they're probably going to bring fire bats at this stage of the game. If you're going up against Protoss and you're waiting for the infamous 12 Zealot rush, try a two Marine, two fire bat configuration and see if that doesn't give you an edge when the Zealots finally show up. At this point, go ahead and fill in those bunkers as you need, and you should have something close to 12 Terran infantry outside of bunkers, as well as an additional 8 inside. Now, once you have your rush defense in place, go ahead and get factories, and get a pair of siege tanks, and get an engineering base. You can get a pair of missile turrets guarding your choke point. If you're playing on one of those weird maps where there's no choke point, try and create some sort of defensive perimeter as tightly packed as possible, so that you aren't having to build or waste too much time building enough siege tanks, bunkers, and missile turrets. Generally, when defending a Terran base, you can think of there being like a triumvirate that makes for a defensive group. A bunker, a siege tank, and a missile turret. One of each of these, the bunker obviously loaded with Terran infantry, is a part of a successful Terran defense. And depending on how many enemies are attacking you, a greater combination of these sort of defensive clusters will hold up against all kinds of enemies. So if you're finding that a two-bunker, two-missile-turret, two-siege-tank defense is not getting the job done, try making a three-bunker, three-siege-tank, three-missile-turret defense. If you find that it's getting the job done but not against air units, try increasing the number of missile turrets, or replacing one of your fire bats with a marine inside of the bunkers. If you find that you're getting rushed too easily, try adding more fire bats to the mix. You should also, while not necessarily doing this immediately, take note of all of the back doors available to your base from air, and see if you can't cover them with missile turrets. If you can get a good missile turret perimeter, that will certainly discourage the AI from attacking you, and will make it so that players will have to take out those missile turrets before they can land forces. Then try to put a couple of bunkers sort of inside, if you have the money to spare. So that you can defend in case anything does somehow manage to land against your missile turrets. However, before you get around to worrying about defending yourself against that backdoor air assault, once you have two missile turrets, two bunkers, loaded up with infantry, and two siege tanks in siege mode, you should be thinking about expanding. You should be building more siege tanks and building more Terran infantry with the express purpose of finding an expansion and taking it. Waiting much longer than this will get yourself into trouble financially later in the game, because I guarantee you your opponent, especially if it's one of the AIs, is already thinking this if they have not done it already. When choosing an expansion to take, it's best to go for your first one that's close to your home base. Now, I know this doesn't seem aggressive, but the reason for doing so is because you don't want your enemy to take it behind your back, because then they can have unit-producing facilities right at your back door, or front door, and that can make it very difficult for you to be able to build from that point on. Besides, it's easier to defend yourself when you're consolidated rather than spread across the map. That's not to say that if you aren't confident and you think it won't pin your enemy in, it's certainly not worth taking one of his further expansions, but if you're not sure of the capabilities of your opponent, you should probably stick to a close-by one. Many Brood War or later developed units or maps have these sort of pocket expansions located right next to start locations. It's good to look for them and rely on them, rather than allowing the risk of your opponent to potentially take them and box you in. When defending an expansion, depending on the tenaciousness of your opponent, it usually is enough to bring a pack of Terran infantry and one or two siege tanks to defend it until you can get around to getting your command center and a few bunkers and missile turrets built, especially in the earlier part of the game. Once you have that expansion built, you will want to eventually add bunkers and missile turrets and set up your siege tanks into the most defensive positions possible. And it might be to your benefit to build a barracks inside of this expansion to help you fill out those bunkers. While it is tempting to go bunker crazy, do keep in mind that every time you fill one of those out, that's 4 supply you're not using, and 4 Terran infantry that could be being used for attacking. Once you have that expansion up, depending on the number of expansions on the map, it might not be a bad idea to think about expanding again. And this time, think about expanding in a way that might deny your enemy resources, as opposed to thinking as conservatively. This way, you can start maybe taking the fight to your enemy, maybe skirmishing them a little bit in the middle of the map, etc. When you get to the point that it's time to start physically taking bases away from the enemy, the best way to do this with the Terrans, if you're going to do it on the ground, is without a doubt with siege tanks. There are many ways to attack with siege tanks, but the most successful ones are the ones that involve the siege tanks being escorted by units that can help them fight against their two counters, air and close combat. If you can do this early, and if you want to do an early game siege tank attack, then just build a pair of siege tanks and a pack of Terran infantry, and keep the Terran infantry back with the siege tanks safely while the siege tanks shell your enemy base into submission. The enemy will have no choice but to send actual units out to fight you, and just leave the siege tank siege mode, and you will have the benefit of previous defense, and you'll just destroy them on the way in. Once done, you can then just slowly, once the siege tanks have nothing left to shoot at, you can just pack them up, move them forward until they're within range of enemy structures, re-siege them, and repeat the process. If you do a good enough job of micromanaging your Terran infantry so they don't go walking headlong into enemy base defenses, or don't accidentally walk your siege tanks headlong into enemy base defenses, you will find that most bases will go down pretty easily against this. Later in the game, Terran infantry probably won't get the job done because you'll need to bring along a science vessel for cloak detection, and you might want to replace them with Goliaths for increased durability and increased anti-air effectiveness. Going up against enemy Terrans, you might want to use infantry instead still, because then ghosts aren't able to lock down your entire attack group at once, and you might have a force able to defend your siege tanks while they're sitting there locked down rather than you losing them entirely, since, you know, a pack of ghosts could lock down an entire Goliath siege tank force by itself. If you do go the Goliath siege tank route, and you can spare the resources, it's also not a bad idea to bring an SCV around, both for taking expansions when you go, but also to repair your units in the field, since Terrans have the wonderful ability of any vehicle unit or air unit at their disposal can be repaired at any time by an SCV for a minimal expense of resources. This is a invaluable ability when you consider the fact that the Zerg and the Protoss, though they have automatic regeneration capabilities, they, you know, typically regenerate at their own pace, and so you're kind of dependent on them, or even in the case of the Protoss with their shield batteries, they have to go back to their home base to do it. Terrans can do it in the field. Also, fun sort of fact is, remember that Terrans can build anywhere on the map. So, you know, if you want to make a defensive stand in, like, a strange place, like the land route to everywhere else on the map, and you want to build bunkers there and set up your siege tanks just to piss your enemy off, it's not necessarily a bad idea. Okay, so let's say that for whatever reason you can't do a ground attack, you know, because the enemy is, or the map is an island map, or you've got a lot of cliffs you got to deal with, so you got to rely on air. Doing an air attack with the Terrans is a little bit more difficult because they don't have a dedicated bomber unit short of the Yamato cannon on the battlecruiser, and it might take you a while to get enough battlecruisers for that to be effective. What you can do is you can rely on the expendability of Terran Marines and the speed of Terran dropships to kind of make hit-and-run drops, or make siege tank drops. And give you an example of how this works. Say an enemy has an island base with a few missile turrets defending it in, like, one bunker. What you can do is you can pack up one or two dropships worth of Terran infantry, pack up another dropship full of siege tanks, and then bring a pack of wraiths. Have the wraiths go in and destroy just enough missile turrets to give the dropships enough space to land. Then, using the unload all command, unload the Terran infantry next to the siege tank and have them siege mode outside of the attack range of the bunker, if possible. The siege tanks will then take out the bunker by themselves, take out the enemy infantry inside them, and then you can unleash your infantry to just cause havoc across the enemy expansion. Of course, the heavier defended the expansion, you may need more units to pull this off. Another option, if that's not working out for you, is to just try and just drop Goliaths instead of infantry or whatever, although the infantry is very effective, especially post-Brood War. Once you get to the end point of the game, it's definitely a better idea to rely on battlecruisers for this kind of victory, or incredibly large groups of wraiths, especially battlecruisers, though, with the Yamato cannon at your disposal. Another option also includes, if possible, going in, taking out missile turrets, and then relying on dropping a ghost to nuke, but this can be a little bit more difficult to enact, since chances are if the enemy had anti-air defenses, that means they have detectors running about. Another viable way to do air is, as previously mentioned, the Victory Fleet, and I think I spent some time talking about that at length. And, of course, you also have nuking at your disposal, which is very handy against a heavily entrenched enemy. Some of the more obscure Terran tactics include early to late game Terran infantry swarms. Now, when going up against the Zerg and the Protoss in the late game, when everybody's sort of running out of money, it can become difficult for those two races, if they don't have them around anymore, to build their units that are effective against swarms. If the Protoss players not researched Psionic Storm or wasted all of their money on Archons instead of keeping Templar with Psionic Storm around, a huge pack of Terran Marines can do a pretty solid job of taking out a Protoss base, or a Zerg base for that matter. We're talking about a pretty sizable pack, like in excess of 50, but sometimes you get to the end of the game and Vespian gas is just scarce, but you have all kinds of minerals stacked up. It's not a terrible way to go. I mean, you can still fight enemy air units, you can still fight enemy ground units. It's just generally not going to work that well against Terran opponents, because siege tanks are still very easy to produce and very good against Terran Marines at just destroying them outright. You can also dropship the Marines in too, though, if you need to get back past enemy lines. I've done some brute forcing with Goliaths. I don't personally recommend it. I find that despite the fact that they should be statistically better than them at it than Hydralisks, that their slower speed and larger profile and slightly dumber pathfinding AI ends up turning into they're just not as good at it. That being said, there are times where they can get that job done pretty well. I still think it's more effective if you pair them up with siege tanks to get that job done, though. It's been a while, but I have played games where I've been able to dominate my enemy with Terran air using Terran wraiths to just harass my enemy, keeping him pinned into his base to the point that he can no longer expand, runs himself dry, and then I can easily kill him with a small group of battlecruisers. It's not a terrible idea either. And I think that might be everything I have to say. I can't really think of anything else that I have in my head. There's a number of different ways to win with the Terrans. They're a very versatile unit, or a very versatile race, and as you heard me say throughout this podcast, you know, special ability, special ability, special ability. They are a race that they're not very effective at the whole select a bunch of them, press the A key, and press inside the enemy base and expect it to go down, but they are outstanding at being able to use their special abilities to counter just about anything you can throw at them. If you're having troubles playing the Terrans, there's probably some ability or unit you're not taking advantage of, and you should see if you can't figure out what that is. Alright, so I hope you have enjoyed the show. Next time, I will be hopefully talking about the Zerg and covering some of the finer points to playing these bug-like aliens. I hope you've been enjoying the show, and I'll see you then.